it originally.
Right, well, and it's in different documents all over the place, it's all different.
Because it changed, yeah. Yeah, the old, like your chainsaw manual's gonna say help, healing and hope.
And on the side of our trailer, it says help, hope, and healing.
I think help, healing, and hope sounds better.
I do too, but that.
Pastor Larry, Keith says it's not a total loss. It might be salvageable. Did you already scrap it?
I did not. Are you wanting to go back in?
Yeah, no, I'm not wanting to, but Pastor Keith says we should go forward, so I'm gonna. My personal feeling is I'm
ready to go.
No, we'll do it. We'll do it. Yes, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. We're going to do it. And how, so, and with the skit, can we just, do we have like a handheld mic for the skit? All right, we'll do it. All right. We can do it. Okay. I know, we did it. Am I generally staying? All right, we're hot. Okay, come on back. So what we have talked about so far, we've talked about who we are, our values and our mission. We've talked about what we do and different ways that we respond. And now we're going to talk about how we did it. And we're not going to be in this chapter real long. I don't think. I want to be sure we give a lot of attention to the very back of the manual, which is actually ministering directly with the survivors.
Don't move. No, you're good.
Thank you. I feel like Taylor Swift with a staff. So we're talking about how we do it. And we're really going to be selective in this chapter. We're going to skip through some things because you can read it yourself. I'm just going to hit a couple of things that seem important to me. We're going to be talking about how we plan, we train, we organize, we partner, we deploy, we evaluate, if that makes sense. And we're going to do this without the slide because Pastor Larry just walked off. In terms of planning, what are the sorts of things that we will be doing during planning? If it's an immediate disaster, if we see the storm coming, if we see the hurricane coming, what leadership is going to be doing is we're going to be talking about where is it likely to hit, what churches are in the area, where if we need to house teams, what church can we house a teacher, can we house teams in? Where would we set up a kitchen? If we need to set up a kitchen in a parking lot, because our feeding kitchens need a parking lot. They're outdoor kitchens. And all of that. Thinking through, are we going to have enough volunteers locally that we can start with Maryland, Delaware volunteers? Can we tell this is going to be a big enough storm that we're going to need to be bringing in volunteers from other states? In which case, we begin calling our disaster relief partners and start lining that up. So that would be planning if something is big on the horizon coming. But planning could also be, for instance, Keith, what you and Alan were talking about out in the hallway during break. It's just thinking about trailers and what would make sense and what do we need and what do we need to get and what do we need to reconfigure because we know what we have is not working like we're going to need it to work in the future. So planning takes a lot. A lot of different.
We need to do groups first, then also find who would be the leader of these groups.
We'll talk about that. This is not like a church mission team. This is more like, I don't want to say the military, but it's like you're going to have a team leader, and that's going to be your leader. We'll talk about it. I don't want it to be sounding scary. And so we're going to go to the next slide. A lot of what we do is training, because again, training is preparation. And I have a friend who was in the military for a while who says that in the military you train like what you need to be doing, like you train to do it. And that's probably true of the fire service and the police and people like that. So in disaster relief, we do the classroom training, which is what you see in the picture. It's what we're doing today. Actually, in the classroom, that is an advanced training. They're sitting in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, several different states, volunteers coming together to take some very specialized professional level feeding training. And they're getting ready to take their exam, which is why Tanya's pretending like she's freaking out in that picture. And she passed, of course. You know, I could have told her she was going to pass. Could you go back to the picture, Larry, if you wouldn't mind? So we do the classroom training, which is what we're doing today, but we also do hands-on training. Now, the feeding people are, you know, they would normally be practicing in the kitchen today. But we set up and do like we would do it in real life. So this, the picture here that you see, if you've got a sharp eye, you recognize that parking lot. That's the parking lot right out here at Grace. And this is the feeding unit that sits out here. And yes, Joe.
I'm sorry. Did you say there's a next level of training for that?
For the feeding, for the feeding team, these are people who have self-selected to take some. Like I've said to some people, would you take this class? Because we need people who know how to, and these are people who've said, you know, what else can I do? So this is the basic training. So when you come out of this today, you've taken the required class, and then you're required to take one of the team classes. So you're going to take the recovery team. So those two things are taken care of. You're going to do your background check. You're going to build your profile. You're like, this is how you can reach me. This is my, emergency contact person. You're going to have paid your money. You will have, what else have you got done? Taken your picture. When all of that's done, you get your badge. And so you're done. And then if you want more training, there's more training. There's more things going on. Alan.
We'd also had a recent training. We went over to West Virginia and had some, believe it or not, advanced ladder training.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you deal with certain things on a roof? So your basic training is good, but if you want advanced training, we do try to get that to keep people involved as well as to enhance. So mm-hmm. We do first aid training as well if mm-hmm. you want it.
Is that like a certification for each thing?
No, it's just your knowledge. Okay. It's just for your knowledge. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, and the steps, I mean, for the feeding, that's serve-safe training. That's like restaurant, what they're getting is basically restaurant manager training to run our mobile kitchen. So that is a certificate class. But, no, it's usually just, or if you want the Red Cross, you know, to pay the money, Alan can, we can arrange the Red Cross to come and do the training. Alan's a certified trainer with the Boy Scouts and does excellent training for us. So... Correct. And actually, nobody has to do it. We just say, would you be willing to get the training? Because we need people. The certification only lasts a certain amount of time, and we need multiple people to have it. Because when a disaster comes, we don't know who's going to be available, and we can't run that kitchen. The health department will not let us run that kitchen without somebody who's current certified. Like, I got trained 10 years ago. So let me see your card. I want to see the date on your card. So that's what this picture represents. This is setting up the kitchen in this parking lot and cooking just for the people who were in the little drill. But it could have just as easily have been setting up this kitchen in a parking lot at for a church plant, doing a block party and feeding people at the block party. But you're doing it as if you were feeding people in a disaster. It would be the same way of doing it. And as Alan said, talking about the chainsaw, folks, it's really hard to simulate flood recovery, I mean, without flooding something. So that one, you kind of have to learn as you go along. But we do, although actually some of us have sat down and we've gotten training from a professional mitigation company where they've just worked with, it wasn't so much hands-on, but just some much more in-depth training. With how we do that. So that's our training. When you train, your badge is going to be good for 3 years. You can, and we talked about this earlier today, while you've still got time on your badge, you can come and take other classes for free. Or if it is Let's just say it's a first, let's just say we're going to bring in the first aid, Red Cross first aid, and they're going to teach, and there's a little bit of a charge for that. We may be able to offset some of that and have two price categories. So there's the current disaster relief volunteers, this is your price, and everybody else, this is your price. Because maybe the church people want to come, but we're just not going to give them the discount. Because our budget can't absorb all of that. Now, this is the national standard up here, that you've got to retake your background check at least every 3 years. And so the date on your badge is actually tied to that background check. Now, I'm going to confuse you. Baptist Convention of Maryland, Delaware, as an organization, that's our parent organization, is very committed to safety and security and child protection and protection of vulnerable people. And so our board has made the policy that every volunteer who serves under the auspices of the BCMD needs to have a background check every year. So what that, so it's the camp workers and for disaster relief. And so what I said was, most of the people we train don't ever deploy. Instead of doing a background check on everybody every year, can we just do a background check on the people who are actually raising their hand and serving? Whether it's serving for one day or for a weekend or for a week, let's just do the people who are actively showing up that year. And they said, yes, that's good. So we've just had 7 weeks of teams serving in South Carolina and North Carolina, and some of them were brand new volunteers, so their badges were very fresh. But we had a lot of people who their background check on this is still good. They're still within the 3 years, but their background check was more than 12 months ago. So there was a frantic back and forth administratively trying to get all these people with a really fast turnaround, get everybody out the door, but they had to have that background check done. When you get your badge done now, like this class, you're getting references, two references. We actually do check the references. The reason your badge will probably be late in getting to you is because the references are slow. So please call your references and tell them to speed it up, that you need this to get your badge. And what they'll do is they'll get, you give us the names, and then the Demetra will work it out, so they will get a form, and they'll fill out the form, and it'll come back to us. When you do the one-year quickie, we don't have time for references, and so we have permission to just, we already have done your references for this. So for the one-year quickie, you just do the regular background check online. And it's just, part of it is just the time, because if we did references, we wouldn't have a team to go, if that makes sense. So it's sort of a compromise. And Pastor Keith, I don't know how you want to be working that, but that's kind of where we are, making it work. And then we just encourage you to participate when we do hands-on, when we do drills, when we do things like that, just to keep your skills current. If your community offers Red Cross training, or if the local fire department offers whatever, tool safety, or if your county offers citizens emergency response teams, assert teams, any training in the community or from other organizations that you think would give you skills to help benefit you serving on a team, take it. Your church says, oh, well, could you go to bus driver school and learn to drive a bus? Say yes, because we can maybe use a bus driver. You never know. So just avail yourself of that. And then in here, there's a lot of good trainings. Again, the steel saw people, and there's just a lot of training out there. So take it, especially if it's free, because it just gives you more capacity. There's more in your toolbox for you to be able to help us. Okay, and so we're gonna organize. Now, the next slide is, I just don't want you to be seeing this and panicking. We're on page 16. This, as my teacher would say, this is not going to be on the test, but I do need to show it to you. This is what The organization chart looks like, for Southern Baptist Disaster Relief, this would be a full-on large-scale disaster. This is going to be Katrina class, Sandy class, Helene class, where you've got multiple states involved, multiple units involved. You've got a whole lot of people involved. This is what it looks like. And at the very top in the middle, you see the affected state convention disaster relief director. There is a saying in the disaster relief world, all disasters are local, that the local people own the disaster. It was their house before the disaster, and when the TV crews and all the volunteers and everybody goes home, it's still going to be theirs. So the local, in Southern Baptist Disaster Relief world, the local state director drives the bus. And they call the shots, and they're the ones who are working out the strategy. They're not working in isolation. They're talking to a lot of people. And they've got their teams and their partners, and they're working through that network. But that's the person who is going to be making the decisions. The North American Mission Board and Send Relief is there to provide resources, to provide connectivity, saying, you know, would you like us to contact other state conventions and get word out to them that you need XYZ on these dates? Yes, please do that. And they will get the word out. They'll be sending the emails to the other state directors to say, do you have teams who could do this, this, and this? And then also on their international side, if this were an international kind of thing, like, I don't know, let's just not talk about it international. This is going to be too complicated for what we're doing here today. Let's just stick with the North American Mission Board. And then the incident commander is going to be, this says incident commander. This is based off of the fire department and what they do and what other governmental organizations do, or first responder organizations, public safety. We in the nonprofit world tend to use the word manager, incident management team, because you can't command a volunteer to do anything. They're like cats. You know, you just can't tell them what to do. But you manage them. You can coach them and manage them. The incident manager is going to be that point person who is going to be just basically managing the operation. And under him or her, There's the public information officer, the safety officer, the liaison, the chaplain, and then operations crew. You see the column on the left. Operations is what we do, stuff we do to serve the community. So that's your flood recovery. It's your chainsaw. It's the mass care feeding. If we're giving public showers and laundry, that's where that's going to be. Chaplains, everything that has to do with what we do. And then logistics, the next column over, is the things we need to do to support the crews in the field. So housing, where are they going to be sleeping? Do they have the equipment? Do we need to rent equipment? All of that kind of stuff. And then administratively, there is just a lot behind the scenes that we have to track. All of those work orders from homeowners, all the hours that the volunteers worked, incoming teams, what teams are in the building now, what teams are we expecting, are we going to have enough beds for everybody? I say beds, but a bed is like a square on the floor. There are situations where you actually measure, the administrative people are going to be measuring the floor and taking tape and taping, like, this is your space, because we know we can only fit X people in this building. If you don't stay in your space, we can't fit this many people in here. And then the liaison officer is working with all the other organizations, coordinating and making sure everything is going on. Now, this sounds like a lot, but just close your eyes. This is a major disaster. I did a disaster once. This was several years ago. A water main break in Dundalk. The water main opened. It poured into basements. About 100 houses were affected. And we got them all cleaned out. But the community said, could you please, since everybody lost their washer and their dryer and their electric, could you please bring your laundry trailer here for 2 weeks and do laundry? And so it ended up being me and two elderly ladies who were really good at washing clothes and really good at talking to people. And so I was everything on this chart. I did everything, and I had a crew of two. So this is what it looks fully expanded when you're running with just a lot. But those functions can be brought down to a small group of people if it's something small. So Pastor Larry, when you were doing the Laurel tornado, you didn't need a staff of 400. You could kind of do this out of your back pocket and have a go-to guy for this and a go-to person for that, and you just did it. But you were doing all this, but you were doing it small. So what you need to know is, and just kind of close your eyes and just imagine, what you need to know is you are going to be assigned to a team. You are going to follow your team leader, who is assigned to be your team leader, and you are going to stay with your team. That's all you need to know. First time volunteers, that's all you need to know. You're going to be put on a team. You're going to know who your team leader is, because we're going to tell you, or else they're going to reach out to you, and you stay with the team leader. You don't say, oh, I like what they're doing better. I'm going to wander over to this team here. No, you stay with your team. And that's it. So that's that. You could do that. You guys can remember, okay, who am I, who's my team leader, and who's my team, and I can stay with them. That's all you need to know. And then, Larry, we're gonna skip on to the, just skip to all the happy people. Okay, so that was organizing. It kind of just lets you know locally, it can be small and very, very easy to do, but when it's big, we can bring in more people. And you might say, there's more people on that chart than we have in Maryland, Delaware. Well, no, we actually have more people than's in that chart. But we can bring in people. Alan was in South Carolina. South Carolina is a big state. They've got a ton of disaster relief people there. In fact, they trained us in some things. They were so overwhelmed when Maryland, Delaware was going down to Anderson to do chainsaw work. They said, oh, and by the way, could you set up the base camp for us and run the base camp for a week or two? Because they were so stretched, they did not have the people to do that. So Alan, in the back row, becomes incident manager and is setting up that base camp so that all the teams can come in and sleep, and coordinating the job orders and the assessors, talking to the community, talking to crisis cleanup, talking to the local church, making sure they have everything that they need to run a base camp and serve the community. They had to, South Carolina, as big as they are, had to call in for extra resources. And so we have no problem bringing in resources when we need it. But it's always the state director who is the one who makes those decisions and coordinates. And that's the person everybody is reporting to as well. It's that person. So now if you could go, oh, I'm sorry, Pastor Larry, if you could go back to all the happy people. So that's the organizing piece. Any questions about that? I know we're going fast. And those of you who've got like fire.
The hats, because that was one of the slides, so they know how the hats.
Oh, the hats. Okay, I didn't bring my hats today because I didn't. Okay, so the hat is you are.
That's right up there too.
Okay, so this is us. This is the worker bees. Okay, we're the goal. The Red Cross calls these yellow, and somehow we started calling these yellow, but these are really gold because our colors are gold and blue. Because remember, gold is the value of the volunteer, the person we're serving, each person in the eyes of Christ. So yellow does not work for that model. These are gold. Gold hat is all of us worker bees. The unit leader or team leader is going to have a blue hat. If it's just you and your team and you're doing something on a Saturday, I mean, you know who your team leader is. It's Alan, or it's Carl, or it's me, or it's whoever. But if you've got a lot of teams working out of one location, you follow your blue hat. And sometimes you'll hear people refer to them as your blue hat. Follow your blue hat, or ask your blue hat. And you're like, my blue hat? It's the person wearing the blue hat. And that is not a rank. That is not something like you always wear the blue hat. You only wear the blue hat on the day where that is your job to wear the blue hat. You can be a blue hat, and then that person might later put on their yellow hat and just be a worker. So it's not like you're always an admiral. And then the person behind the scenes, that incident manager, is going to be wearing a white hat, and that just because it makes it real easy for people to find that person. You're the white hat. And so Alan, for instance, when Alan was doing incident management, he had on the white hat just so people knew who he was and could find him easily, locate him. But he also, a week or two later, was wearing his blue hat because he was team leader. But if Carrie is running the team and Alan's just going to give him some extra labor, he'd be wearing his yellow hat. So it's just very fluid. It just represents what you're doing on that particular day. But all of us have yellow hats. I'm saying yellow hat. What did I just tell you? They're gold. Sorry. It's just hard to learn new tricks. Okay, so that's organization. Thank you, Pastor Larry. So we talked about partnering. Come back to partnering. So thank you. So who are some of our partners that we've already talked about? Okay, local church, that's a big one. That's our faith. We could partner. And I tell you, I personally partner with the fire department because the first day we were out with the laundry trailer, we had 100-pound propane things. And what George said to me is, whatever you do, there was no ramp. We had to set it down, like just set it down. And there was no way that these two old ladies and I were going to set it down without me having fear of blowing us up. So the fire department was right across the street, and I walked over and I said, hey, could you guys come over? Could you big, strong young guys come over and help us move these tanks down? And they did, but I didn't know this. They had to put on their gear and get in their truck and drive across the street to do this for us because they had to be ready for a fire. But that was my big partnership with the fire department. I was very grateful. And then after that, the church came and did it for us every day, so that was good. So who's in this? This is Newcastle County, so right up the road, a tornado that came through a few years ago. On the left, Teresa, Southern Baptist Disaster Relief. We have two from Team Rubicon. We have the homeowner, and we have Pastor Rich with the Methodists on the right. That's who we had, and we had more people this day, but they were just repping. They were just repping for the organization with this picture. We also partnered with the Air Guard cadets. So we had teenagers pulling branches for us. We had the Lions Club. We had the Rotary Club. We had Church of the Brethren. We have Methodists from Pennsylvania who came over. And the way this worked was the Delaware Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster, which is a group of all the nonprofit and faith groups that work together in disaster, said to us, you guys are best at standing up a response. You guys know how to organize it. You know how to do the admin. You guys know how to do the homeowner end of it, the safety stuff. You know how to run a team. Would you be the lead organization? And we're just going to ask all the other organizations to come in and work under you. And we said, fine. And that's exactly what we did, but we could not have done this with just Baptists because there just weren't enough of us. We were out here every Saturday for 10 Saturdays to do the work. It was just local commuter, but we just didn't have the person power because some of these were huge, huge jobs, just a lot of trees. So we partner, and actually we have the same arrangement with the Maryland VOAD, Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster. We are one of the few organizations who actually has skill and experience in running an operation. And what Maryland VOAD will say is, would you take the lead on this? We'll get the word out to all the organizations, and you just work with them, and they'll volunteer, and you assign them, and that's what we do. And we just say to them, do you have a crew chief? Do you not have a crew chief? We work it out, and we know each other well enough. We trust each other, and we've had people give us, lend us their trucks, their equipment, their people, their buildings, because they know that we will take good care of it and we'll give it back to them, at the end of the deployment. So that's what this picture is. And then the next picture is our favorite partner is the local volunteer, the local church. Little girls, talking to their church about donating water and Gatorade for the volunteers so that the disaster relief volunteers are okay. A church plant coming out to help us drag branches. And the beauty of it is it was their community. So here's the church plant out here meeting homeowners. So when we left, who was there to continue ministering to the families? It was that church plant. The bottom picture, Lynn Haven Baptist down in Pocomoke. We had, after Hurricane Sandy, which slammed into Crisfield, we had a whole bunch of flood recovery houses and some chainsaw work to be done. And we needed a place to sleep. So we had 50, 75 people a night for several weeks down in Lynn Haven. And then you recognize Pastor Larry there. This is the Laurel Tornado. And the church actually took care of it. And we said, do you need disaster relief help? And Pastor Larry said, we got this. And I said, just use the homeowner forms, get signed permission, count your hours. And it worked out great. Okay, we also, so we train, we organize, and we train and we organize so that we can deploy, so that we can actually do stuff. And in your book, we're on page 18, thank you. This is where we're going to kick into that little, if you know, let's see, how will I know if I'm needed to serve? We pulled this out. This same information is in your manual, but this is a little bit of abbreviated. And this is, if you can't find your manual, you'll at least know that this little cheat sheet is in your folder. The way we reach you in a disaster is usually by email. We don't have the capacity right now to text you. I can text individuals, certain people I have the text, I text, but as a group, we send batch emails to people. So we'll email the whole database or just the recovery people or just the feeding people. So if you change your email and don't tell us, we can't reach you when we're offering training, when we've got a chainsaw drill coming up, when we've got a deployment coming up, we can't reach you. So it's really important to keep your information current. When something is afoot, you'll get a preliminary email that says alert. An alert just means heads up. It means there's a possibility that we'll be asked to serve. There's a hurricane coming and it looks like it's tracking to the Delmarva. Well, that's, you know, it could go out to sea, but it might be coming and it's about a week away. So heads up. Start looking at your calendar and be thinking, is this something I can do? Or it could be there was a tornado. Well, tornado is a bad example. Let me not use that. It could be that there's a major thing in another state nearby. Let's just say something happened in Pennsylvania. And so we might just say this big thing is going on in Pennsylvania. We might be needed. Just heads up. They haven't asked us for help yet, but if they do, we want to be quick and be ready to respond. Once it is determined that we are going to be needed, you know, the hurricane did hit us. There was a tornado here. Pennsylvania does need help. We'll reach out to you and say, we're looking, it's a standby team. We're looking for people who are just ready to go. We need you to look at your dates. Can I go? What do I need to do to get ready to go? How long can I go? And get back with me. And the way we do it right now is we have a sign-up genius. And in the email, I'll say, you know, we're currently forming teams to stand by to respond. These are the dates. This is the team we need. We're looking for recovery team people. We're looking for feeding people. It might be we're looking for recovery people and two admin people. It's going to say what we need. There's going to be slots, and you can just go in and sign up. Once we have that team formed up, then let's just say Alan is the team leader for that team. He is going to start communicating with you directly. I'm talking to Alan saying, Alan, dot, 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 dot. And then he's going to say to you, okay, we're going on this day. This is where we're going to be. We're sleeping at this church. They have showers. They have laundry, blah, blah, blah. So your team leader is going to be communicating with you at that point. Don't worry about remembering all this. It's just a lot to remember. You'll get the email. Just read the email and do what it says. You might say, I am a feeding worker. Why am I getting a notice for recovery. Well, it's because I'm sending it out to everybody, because there, I might need some people who are feeding. But I might also say, we need recovery. We, if we have room on the team, we can take a couple people who are not recovery trained who want to go out with us. So feeding people, laundry people, you can go with us to do recovery, but just know you're pulling branches or you're dragging bags out of the house. And I want you, and just so everybody knows, there's something going on, so you can be praying. And I probably just really confused you by oversimplifying things. But that's what the deployment looks like. Now let me see. Yes, please do.
So when we know there's a call out that something's going on, first thing that Ellen will do is contact all the blue hats that have units and find out what our availability, you know, when is your unit, the trailer, available, and do you have a leader? And then that's when she puts, okay, those are the dates she puts out. And so you guys have a unit over here. Your whoever, let's say, the pastor is your blue hat, he may be available on a certain week, and so, okay, your trailer's going out that week, but you're not available, but you can, you happen to be available the week that Blue Ridge's unit's going out. You don't have to ride with your own. I mean, I'm sure he would love to have his people ride with him, but you don't have to ride, you know, we cross the state all the time.
It's whoever's available
whoever's
that week,
available.
Whoever's available, who fits that description.
Right.
We need X. Yeah. And that's how you meet a lot of people. That's how you meet a lot of people. If it's small and local, it tends to be the local, like your local group. But if it's something bigger, it's, Alan's absolutely right. We build it around, do we have a trailer? Do we have a team leader? Do we have a driver to pull the trailer? And then it's whoever, we just open it up, whoever's available to go. Absolutely. And the big takeaway, if I could go to the next slide, the big takeaway is disaster relief volunteers do not self-deploy. We don't, you know, I see something is going on in somewhere. I don't just jump in the car and say, I'm a disaster relief worker, here I am. I certainly don't go out of state to do that. In Maryland, Delaware, our responsibility is Maryland, Delaware. I mean, that's our area of responsibility. We are part of the Northeast region, Region 3. So it's from Maryland all the way up the coast to the Canadian line. So Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, all of New England, that's our region. Very often, if something happens big up there, they will reach out and call us. We don't just jump in the car and assume. We don't go. We wait until we're invited, and then we go. To another state. Likewise, other states won't come here unless we invite them. If something happens locally, so if like there's a tornado in this county, what Pastor Larry would do is we would be talking and we would be saying, there's this tornado. And then I would say, Larry, can you guys handle this? And he'd say, yeah, we've got it. And then they would just do it. So, but he didn't just randomly go off and do it. We talked about it. So it's on the radar. So we don't self-deploy as teams. We don't self-deploy as individuals. That's a little bit different from a church mission team. If a church wants to collect stuff and take it to somewhere, that's fine, or bring volunteers, that's fine. But we just say to them, you know, do you have a church? Do you know where you're going? Have you already talked to them? Do they know you're coming? And we just do a church-to-church partnership in that case, rather than disaster relief. So we don't self-deploy.
So would they do it through this group?
Well, for no. What we help facilitate churches.
So, I'll give you an example. When we went to South Carolina, North Carolina, we went church to church with a church partner. But before we deployed, I talked to her. We still coordinated logistically. Mm-hmm. She knew it was a church to church partnership. We were operating under a different local church in South Carolina. And we were not deploying officially as Southern Baptist Disaster Relief. We were just going and doing a church mission trip.
Right.
Under the local church in South
Carolina. And your church, so he wore his church t-shirt, and because of that, now he had a couple disaster relief volunteers. Yeah. They wore their church t-shirt, and then he invited a bunch of untrained church people, and I don't know if they were trained. I don't know if they were background checked. I don't know, because it was a church. I don't tell churches what to do, but I do help them, and I can help churches find churches, but it's a church-to-church thing. It's not a disaster relief, because if it's disaster relief, we got to run on the railroad track. Churches can kind of go off-road sometimes. And sometimes they shouldn't. Sometimes I have gotten calls from churches, because this is Katrina, saying we've got a tractor trailer of stuff, and where do we take it? And I said, well, where are you supposed to be taking it? And they said, well, we don't know. Where is it needed? And I'm like, I have no idea where it's needed. And I really don't have 3 hours right now to call around for you. I'm not trying to be ugly, but we're trying to get teams out the door. So it was, we just stay in our lane. We just stay in our lane. So,
central command, let
them right, absolutely. We just kind of do air traffic control. So when we deploy, yeah, let's go ahead to the next slide. We're working off this sheet, but we're kind of skipping around. So when we deploy, if it's a commuter situation, where are you sleeping at night? In your own bed, and you're eating your own food. If we're going somewhere for a weekend or for a week, for instance, if we're in Lynn Haven in Pocomoke, Alan and I are going to be sleeping at the church, but Larry might say, I'm going to just drive from Seaford to Pocomoke every day and make it a commuter situation. So it's going to depend. But if we're sleeping at the church, this is kind of the worst case scenario. We try to use Sunday school rooms if we can. But this is why in your list of things to bring, it will say bring a cot or a camping pad or a single air mattress. And husbands and wives, we're going to have the men in some areas and the women in other areas. We don't have like couples because we don't have space. For real, we don't have space. And if you have a double air mattress and this room, we figured out we could put 7 people in this room, and you bring a double, we can't put 7 people in this room. And so this is why. Cots, you can see in the picture, are great because you can put stuff underneath the cot. They take up a lot less space. You can see why you're going to need a flashlight at night. If you come in late, you're tripping over people. If you have to get up and use the restroom in the middle of the night, you're tripping over people. I'm actually impressed at how far these beds are apart from each other. Sometimes they're a lot closer than that. So just think about camping indoors. If you've been like on a mission trip, you kind of understand camping indoors. You're sharing the hall bathroom, so you want to be really modest in what you wear. There is in Maryland, Delaware, the shower is probably going to be a shower trailer because we don't have a lot of churches with showers. Your meals are going to be provided on site. Let me just talk a little bit about schedule. Go on back, Larry, if you could back up and just stay there for a little while. So if this is our base camp, our meals are going to be provided by the feeding team. They're going to get up super early in the morning and have hot breakfast ready. You're going to get up, have hot breakfast. There's going to be a little bit of a devotion in the morning. There's going to be a safety briefing, just kind of a like this is what the day is going to be. The teams, while they're there, before they leave, the kitchen would have set up a lunch line, and you go through very, very quickly, and you make your lunch. They've already made the sandwiches. You go through the line. You make your bag lunch. Put your name on it. Somebody from your team has the responsibility to make sure all the bags get put in a cooler. Someone on your team has the responsibility of filling the cooler with ice and the water. And your team leader is going to make that assignment so that you, when you leave for the day, you've got everything you need with you in the trailer. You're going to do your job. You're going to come back in the evening. If it's flood recovery, you're absolutely going to get a shower. If you're chainsaw, you're going to want to get a shower and get cleaned up and put on like your regular clothes, leaving your muddy boots or your muddy shoes at the door of the church. You're not tracking that stuff in. A lot of people take their clean shoes and leave them by the door, so when they bring in their dirty park their dirty shoes, they've got their clean shoes right there. And you're going to have dinner. A nice hot dinner cooked by the feeding team, and there will be another devotion and a debriefing time where you share what happened during the day. Alan, when you're doing a debriefing, for instance, in South Carolina, what would you cover in a daily debriefing to give them an example?
Start off with what the team went through that day. I always follow the roses, thorns, and buds model of just what went right, what went wrong, what can we improve on, what do we need to pray about. One of the things that I started doing in South Carolina was over all of our deployments, you always tell prayer concerns of the people, and we actually started journaling those so that we had a spot where people could write down their prayer concerns so that we could remember them from day to day and continue to pray on them. And again, the South Carolina mission was pretty easy. We did run into some tragedies, and we got to deal with that as far as, teams running across. We had one homeowner that died the day that we showed up. The homeowner had a massive coronary cardiac arrest early that morning, and our team shows up, "Hi, we're here to fix your roof." And, oh, wow, boy, we ran into something. So, again, it's a lot of divine appointments. God sets those appointments up, and then our people were right there to minister to that family. As they're now having to plan a funeral on top of the tree on the house.
Thank you for that. Yeah, and that demonstrates the flexibility that we have to have in the field of immediately pivoting to what is the more urgent need.
Can I jump in on one thing that you said earlier?
Sure.
I hate jumping in on top of you here, but when Ellen was talking about we don't self-deploy, the key thing on that is this is the neat part about being a Southern Baptist. Is that we have the biggest resource pool. We are one of the largest. When you go into a disaster, the last thing you want to do is compete for resources that the local people, like we were in North Carolina a couple years ago on the Outer Banks, and a storm surge went all the way across this, I don't know what you call it, Isthmus Peninsula, whatever it is. Well, when the storm surge goes across that, every gas station has now been contaminated because the water went over top. And then when they get power back on, the state's got to come in and inspect them. So bringing gas stations back online was very hard for the local community. But the gigantic resources that we have as the partnership of Southern Baptists, so Maryland, Delaware is in North Carolina helping them, and they call upon Virginia, calls upon one of their resources and arranged to have a tanker truck from Norfolk drive down to us every day and fill us up with fuel so we're not competing against the resources for the local people. You don't want to be the second part of the disaster. And that's the unique thing about Southern Baptist, the cooperative program, Annie Armstrong, the whole bit. You don't realize how this all plays together to make this work. The churches have no clue as to when they give their little Annie Armstrong how that really, that giant thing works and allows us to do what we do without being a pain on the locals.
Yeah, and that's so important. And that's why we house in a church.
Yep.
So that we're not taking motel space, because that's where the local people need to be. Absolutely. Thank you. So this gives you an idea of what the living conditions are like, what a day is like. And as Alan said, we're going to just, as part of your spiritual preparation, logistically, you're getting ready for this, and this is what you're packing. You're making arrangements ahead of time. You're thinking ahead of time, talking to your employer, to your family, making arrangements. If I go, who's going to walk the dog? Who's going to teach my Sunday school class? Doing all that ahead of time So you don't call your boss Monday morning saying, hey, guess what, I'm in North Carolina this week. Thank you for sharing that. Enlisting prayer support, your small group, your church, your Sunday school to be praying for you while you do this. Alan talks about, we do share prayer requests in the evening as part of deployment. We share information, what, you know, what's coming up, what broke, you know, fixing it. We do share prayer requests. We try to be very careful to protect confidentiality. And so when we're in a deployment, we really ask you to, and we'll talk about this later, don't take pictures without permission of the homeowner. Don't put identifiable information in the picture, like no house numbers or things like that. Be very, very, very careful what you post to Facebook or social media. Very, very careful. It's one thing to put a picture of your team. It's a whole other thing about people's house. We want to be keep it confidential unless they give us permission. Prayer requests, when we come back in the evening, we're not going to say, oh, you need to pray for Sarah Jones, the homeowner we work with, because she's living with a boyfriend she's not married to, and blah, 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 blah. That is not necessary. God is already aware of Ms. Sarah's issues. It might just be, please pray for the homeowner that we work with. She's just got a lot of life challenges, period. And we can remember, okay, so now we're going to pray for their homeowner. I don't even know who they are, but I'm praying for Alan's homeowner. God knows who that person is. And likewise, when we talk to our churches, don't share all the personal details about everything. You're in people's houses, so you're going to know a lot about them. You don't need to tell that. I mean, the only exception would be is it a reportable situation? Is there something in that house that needs to be reported, like abuse or something like that? Yes.
Mm-hmm. That stuff is people's belongings.
Yes.
It's not junk.
Yes.
Garbage.
Yes.
So some of the things, you know, they had to be very respectful.
Absolutely. And you'll hear more about that in recovery class. What can be salvaged? What can be salvaged? What needs to be thrown away? And different teams are different. And now I'm getting into Alan's recovery class, and I apologize. But everybody handles it differently. In urban situations where everybody is really tight, I don't like putting people's personal stuff right out on the sidewalk. If it's going in a dumpster, that's different. But if it's going to be on the sidewalk, for me as a team leader, I prefer to put everything in contract bags so that the neighbors just see contract bags. They're not seeing the stuff to comment on. But also, so when the homeowner looks out there, they're not seeing their possessions out there. They're seeing bags. They know that their stuff is in the bags, but they only see the bags. And so they're, you know, able to emotionally step back a little bit. And they're also not tempted to go back and pull something out of the pile and take it back into the house. But we do want to be very, very respectful and not comment on anything in there.
And it depends on the individual homeowner.
Yes. And
Al.
Yes, and Alan will talk more about that in his class, because they deal with that all the time. So our next couple of slides, so we deploy so that we can specifically do things. And this is Pastor Carey. He is not really lifting that tree. He just wanted to pose for that picture so we think he's awesome. Lisa doing flood recovery. So we go to do things, and the next slide, you're going to see. This is sort of the spiritual side. Alan, I think this is your team in Immokalee, I believe. Praying, and Alan will talk more about this in his class, but a big part of recovery is you've been working with people all day long. And before the team goes, they're going to sign a Bible, write a little note to the homeowner and sign it, and then give it to the Bible and pray for them. Sometimes it may just be, if it's somebody that you get the vibe that this is a person, having a lot of people stand around in a circle and look at them and hold hands, that might not be their thing. So it might just be the team leader or one or two members of the team presenting and praying on behalf of the team. But we do really try to pray over and pray with our people. On the right-hand side, you see, you know, this is during COVID, so that's why they're separated like they are. But even if it's just one person, that Eric was leading this little group, praying for that homeowner, and they would have been talking with the homeowner throughout the day, just checking in on them, making sure they're okay. And Alan will talk more about that in his class. In the deployment, and this is also in your book, your little guide, pages 20, I think these might be the old numbers. These are the old numbers, I'm sorry. This is the new manual. On page 16 and 17, some practical guidelines of what you're going to need to know. You're going to need to know that packing list, what to take. Your team leader will give you some good ideas when you're talking to him or her about what you need. You're going to need a volunteer release form. In your manual, in the back of your manual, these are just samples. This is just sort of the national template. Every state does it their own way. But if you look on page 25, there's a sample medical release that you'll be asked to fill out when you get on site. Just asking, that's the type of information they're going to ask for. On the back is a liability release, a waiver. You'll be asked to sign something like that. Again, this is sort of the national template. Every state is a little bit different, but you're going to be asked to do that. And that's the paperwork that you're going to bring when you take down. So that's some of the practical considerations. Let me look, is there anything else urgent here? There's also going to be some health things, some ethical things on page 16 and 17. So you're going to want to spend some time with that. And we've already talked about some of the ethical standards. We really want to remember at all times that we're representing Christ. Our actions, our attitudes, what we say. Looking at, normally we would be playing a little game at this point, but I know we're running out of time, so I'm just going to be kind of task focused here and just be reading these to you. We don't accept contributions on the field. People are going to want to pay us money because they appreciate what we do, and we just say to them, "I'm sorry, ma'am, we don't accept contributions. That's our policy." If they, you know, you're going to direct them to your team leader and just say, "Ma'am, talk to our team leader." And the team leader will say, "Well, ma'am, that's very kind of you. We don't accept contributions, financial contributions." And if they really, really want to give you money, then the team leader will give them the website and they can go online and they can donate. And the team leader will say, "This will go into the general response fund, and so we'll be able to use this for other you know, buying materials and things for other responses." Like, we're not going to split this money amongst the team. It's going to go for more things. And if they want to bring you cake or buy you a pizza, that's different. You know, they can do that. Why do we not collect money? Why do we not accept donations from the people we have? We're not there for money. We're there for the help. One of our very best witnessing lines is to say, "God's love is free. Our help is free," as an act of love. If we collect money from people, we've just lost that, connection with them. Now, we have had people send, there was one particular person who we helped, and they had some, I mean, we could tell, looking at the house, we knew that they had insurance and things like that, but the insurance doesn't cover. If the tree is not on the house, the insurance doesn't cover it. So we were doing some work for this person just to help them out. We only did half a day for them, and they had a whole lot more trees than we got to. And a couple weeks later, a check for $1,000 appeared. It was from her. She was just grateful. She said, "This is for you to help more people." So we didn't ask for money. She just later followed up on it.
That's always come, just pay it forward.
Pay it forward. Okay, do's and don'ts. So on your table, you've got some cards, do's or don'ts. On your table, you've got cards, do's or don'ts. All right, this is a game show. Do's or don'ts. Okay. Is it a do or a don't? You can play two. All right, you got one. All right. People in the back, you're going to miss out. Okay, expect to only work with your group. Your group. All right. I didn't say your team. I said your group, like all the people from your church. Don't. Yeah. Yeah, you are going to do, if it's your team, you're going to be with your team, but not like your group. Like, she's on that, we want our church to be together. All right, expect to work with the exact same people every day. Do or don't. Don't, because we just don't know. Yeah, don't. It's going to be, every day is going to be different. Make adjustments as needed. Do, good job. Attempt to meet needs you are not trained to handle. Yeah, don't offer to drive the truck if you don't know how to drive a truck. Attempt to meet needs you are not trained to handle. All right, this is not on here, but give the homeowner advice about what they're... No, we don't do that. Yeah, we're not allowed to give advice because we're not professionals. Tell everyone else what they should do. Okay, unless you're the team leader, in which case you have permission. Understand your physical limitations. Do. Now here's a tricky one. Inform your leaders of your special interests and abilities. What do you think? Do. Yeah, do. It helps your team leader to know. I mean, if you're dealing with something like you're doing flood recovery and you discover a serious plumbing problem and it just so happens that somebody on your team is a plumber, that's good. I mean, like if the pipe is about to burst, yeah, that's good. Now, expecting them to cater to you is different. You know, like I only do this. No. But if it's offer. Okay, good job. All right, so, and then ethical, we've already talked about this. I didn't realize it was here. So we're going to skip through. Okay, so Larry, the slide that talks about preparation. As a volunteer, you have the responsibility for your own personal preparation, motivation, attitude, availability, participation, training, and improvement. Of all of those things, what is the one thing that you're probably going to struggle with? You think. Oh, attitude. The pastor says attitude. Okay, that's interesting. Okay. What's one thing that you're going to struggle with the most? Availability? I would say for 95% of us, it's availability. It's getting the time free, which is why a lot of times people say, well, disaster relief is all a bunch of old people. It's because the old people are available right then. But on weekends, we see a lot of everybody else. Or if we're saying we're going out for 6 weeks, pick which week you can come. That works better.
Because weekends ain't no more like it used to be.
Well, I know that, but well, and as a housewife who I have, as a housewife, Saturday is a work day for me. It's just with the vacuum cleaner. So I get it. But so you are responsible for all of that. And then thinking through with regard to our values, you know, just remembering as we go out, as we deploy, are my actions and words and attitudes strengthening our reputation, integrity? Do they represent Jesus well? And it's not about making our ministry look good. It's just we want Jesus to look good, but people know. I mean, it says Baptist on the back of the shirt, so they know we're church people. We want, if we look good, it makes Jesus look good. And then just making sure, this disaster relief isn't for everybody, so if at the end of the training day you say, you know, this is not for me, that's okay. Just tell us and we'll take your name off the database. It means God has something else for you to do. If you know that you're a crabby person, if you know that you're somebody who does not take orders well, if you're somebody who just cannot bear to sleep on the floor because you got to have the comforts of home, and we're not judging anybody, it's okay. This is just not for you. And if you're especially, if you've got to be super flexible, super, super flexible. And if that's not you, that's okay. Larry, let's skip this one and let's go to the next one. And We're going to go to types of survivors. Okay, so this is a section where we're talking about working with survivors. And we're going to be on page, and these are the numbers from the old manual. So, and since I gave Pastor Larry the wrong PowerPoint, so table one, if you could really quickly read what direct survivors are and be prepared to tell us. Table two, if you could look at indirect. Table three, if you could look at hidden survivors. I want to come back to you in about 60 seconds. You don't need to have it memorized, but just tell us something about what these people are. Because right now we're talking about, from now until the end, we're talking about survivors. You guys are doing the direct victim, the direct survivor. The direct survivor. Okay, you got it in your head? Okay. So just say in your own words, just a sentence, what is a direct survivor, or whatever what your survivor is, and give an example. So some of you guys have a lot of sentences. Just kind of reduce it to a thought. Okay, hold on. So the direct survivors would be? Who are the direct survivors? Okay, it's more than they live in the disaster area. The tree fell on their house. So it happened to them. Yeah, absolutely. It happened to them directly. Indirect. What's an indirect survivor?
People who live in the area but haven't necessarily been directly impacted.
Okay. So if it's a tornado, you could actually be living right across the street.
Right.
Like you saw it happen. But it didn't happen to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And are they affected at all by being in this? I mean, like emotionally,
yes.
Does they?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Stress.
Yeah.
Same resource constraints as somebody who was directly affected.
So they don't have all the physical damage, but they're going to have some emotional, psychological.
Like they might not be able to get supplies or gas or whatever.
Oh. Yeah, that's good. Like if it pulled down electric lines, it could be affecting them. And the indirect people.
Well, your volunteers and associations helping are going to have some level of emotional impact, especially if they invest themselves.
Okay, so this is kind of giving you the DR example. In the real world example, this would be your first responders, the people who are carrying the load of the community. And what happens is it is more than they can carry. And the emotional stress, they're not with their families, they're exhausted. And so we see substance abuse and just all kinds of stuff going on. Not that they're bad people, these are totally overwhelmed people. And so how do we as volunteers, we don't work with them directly, but we might encounter them. Realm, let me say this differently. Who is local in the area who might know who those first responders are, who could give them love and support? The local church. The DR teams are very focused and we're only there for a little while, but the local church. And that is a great ministry. And then just thinking through before the storm, you know, if something were to happen here, how could we support these people? Encourage them. I don't mean like make them come and speak and, you know, like all that. Don't add to their stress. But how do we, like, one thing is to make sure the disaster relief teams, if their homes were messed up, that the disaster relief teams know so they can do them first to free them up so they're not worrying about it. But yeah, so these are the three kind of survivors that we see. The next slide, this is going to be on page 21. We have the different stages of how, like, the emotions that people go through. And I'm going to ask you guys to do this again. And this time, if the three of you all could look at heroic, just very, very briefly. We don't need the whole thing. And Larry, if you and George could do the honeymoon. Don't take a honeymoon, just be on the honeymoon. If you guys could be disillusionment and reconstruction. And what we're looking at is just emotionally, what are people dealing with? And then, Larry, we're going to go to the next slide. Okay, while they're still studying, they're still looking at theirs. Okay, you kind of have it. You can cheat and use your paper. So, in this diagram, you know this from your own life. When something happens, do you go from bad to is this the line of recovery in your life? No, what does it look like? Up and down. So we see on the left the pre-disaster. And then the impact, it goes down. This is where I wish I had a really long pointer. At the bottom is where it impacts. And then this is the rescue. We're rescuing people. And heroic, their emotion, the survivors are in the heroic mode right after impact and as we're like in that zone. And what is the heroic? What is that first stage emotionally for them? I really need a pointer for this. Yeah. Yeah, it's whatever it takes, and they're the superhuman is what comes to mind. That they are doing, they're like, I think of the like grandmother in the basement with a broom sweeping all night long to keep the water from coming in under the door to her basement. You know, it's that kind. Or the neighbor running over and they're lifting the tree off of, you know, the child kind of thing. It's just they're running on adrenaline. And then their emotion is going to go up. And now we're in the what we would call recovery, like when we're doing chainsaw and flood recovery. The honeymoon, and what is the emotionally? What is going on during that honeymoon phase, when their emotion is really high? It's very positive.
Camaraderie, connection, empathy that's being built between people.
Can you guys hear what he's saying? Say it really loud.
There's camaraderie, and empathy with one another, especially here.
Okay, they're pulling together. They're pulling together as a community. This is my brother's family. The whole street lost power. For a big thunderstorm, and they all lost power, and it was out for a couple days, so they all took all their freezer food and all their grills in the middle of the street, and they had this giant cookout, and they cooked all their food, and it was like, oh, we can do this, we're awesome. But then disillusionment sets in because things aren't working out like they thought. And so what... In the disillusionment phase, how are people feeling?
Well, I've actually helped people with some of that from the tornado. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing is the timing. All the emotions they've gone through, they've gotten past the why, and now they're frustrated, anger, and actually have a helpless feeling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they can't see the hope that's there. And they get mad about it,
mm-hmm,
because,
mm-hmm,
nothing's being done fast enough.
Yeah, I they can't do it themselves. They find out that the insurance check is not as big as they thought it was going to be, and the building supplies are more, you know, because the price goes up. They see that other people are getting help down the street, and why is nobody coming to my house? It really is a very dark time for them. It's very difficult. And then slowly, and we're talking days and days and weeks and months and sometimes years, they're beginning to step up. And when it says reconstruction, that's more than just reconstructing a house. It's reconstructing your life, putting your life together. And remember, disaster relief is not here for the reconstruction. Who's here? The church. So church, even though it's been months or a year or two, who in your community might still be in that phase and need love and support and encouragement?
You just said one word that's, mm-hmm, been made, is a community.
It's a community. It's a community.
Midwest, when we had the center of town. And at the time, I thought it was going to hit my house because I lived right on that. But for some reason, they decided to go south and then loop around through there. But the disaster, I mean, it wiped out the whole central Main Street all the way through.
And people had to pull together. Yeah.
And all the horror and everything that went with that. It was the community that pulled together to help everybody.
Yeah, yeah, for everybody to get there together. And so reconstruction, what is going on emotionally with people here?
Probably closer to the acceptance phase, and they're starting to feel, you know, like they have the ability to rebuild.
Okay, so acceptance, and sometimes that acceptance is, this is not going to be what it was before. But it's a new life, and I'm not really happy about it, but we're stepping into it. We're going to move forward with what we have. Yeah, absolutely. That they're solving their own problems and not somebody is not going to be there to solve it for them, that they're going to make, you know, do that. And one thing I've seen that's been really positive church-wise is, for instance, Ellicott City, which people died in Ellicott City during the 2016 flood. And it really was a community pulling together. But the faith community got together on the first anniversary of the flood, got together, had an ecumenical service, but opened it up to everybody. And they, recognized the deceased, like a little memorial, but also thanking the volunteers, thanking the neighbors, and it was a religious service, so it was, you know, liturgies, and not like liturgy, but like responsive readings and things like that, and a sermon and some singing, and then a fellowship afterward, a nice fellowship outside where everybody could come. But it was the sort of thing that neighbors who were not religious might still come, because it was a celebration of surviving together. It was really a celebration of community. And that really went a long way towards helping to heal the community. So thank you, Pastor. So in this next slide, this is not in your book. Some of the emotions then, people go back to the little circles if you could, the little pictures. The people go through these at different stages, and you can have the same, especially in the first couple of days and weeks of a disaster, you might have multiple emotions in the same day. I mean, a day might look like this. So when you walk into a homeowner's house, you don't know how they are. And look at those emotions. What are some things that you see up there?
Blaming.
Anger. Okay, Superman, I can do this. I'm juggling too much. I'm trying to figure out how the pieces go together. On the bottom right hand, the man and woman, how many relationships get damaged with this? That picket fence, how many barriers are between me and what I want to do? Or everything is rosy. Or the guy in the bed with the EKG, do people have physical problems related to the stress? Yeah. All kinds of stuff. So when we go in, we just need to be really very gentle, very sensitive, and not judgy, and say, you know, this thing was a week ago. Pull yourself together. Well, it was a week ago for you, but for the person going through it, it's today. You know, it's where I am today. So you want to be really sensitive. And then, Larry, if you could skip down to where it says physical effects of disaster. Oh, you got it. So, just very briefly, your book is going to explain this way better than I can. God has given us the flight or flight response. So, if something like if a bear is chasing you, the adrenaline kicks in, or if something happens to your kid, like the mom lifts up the car to pull the kid out. It's that hit of adrenaline, which is very good in a survival mode. But your brain is not designed to run on adrenaline for days and for weeks, which is what happens in a disaster situation for these homeowners. And so what happens is it begins to physically affect people's brains. The right side and the left side of the brain don't talk together as well. Parts of your, like your your executive functioning, the part of your brain that makes decisions, is not functioning as well. It's not because you're stupid. It's because the chemicals in your body are not conducive to clear thinking. And so people lose their ability to think clearly, to communicate complex thoughts. If you're trying to figure out a recovery plan for yourself and the finances and all the steps you need to take and all the paperwork, you're looking at the FEMA paperwork, and it's the sort of thing that, you know, it's like doing taxes. You're looking at going, I have no idea what this is. It's very difficult to do that when your brain is in this mindset. Consequences of their behavior, people do stupid things and they just can't see what the consequences are going to be. People just do stupid things, and you think, why did this person do this? It's not because they're stupid. Normally, they would never do that. It's because their brain is not functioning like it would. So again, we want to be very gentle with people, very sensitive. Your book is going to have some good information in there about working with people and helping people in that situation. And just churches, just know if people in your church are going through this, just really walk with them and say, you know, if you need help with the paperwork or if you need help, you know, if I can go with you to the FEMA office, just to be supportive. Don't take over their life, but just ways that you can be supportive and help them with that. And if we had time, I would share a story about this really sweet lady and some very, very bad decisions she made. And then Disaster Relief was able to help her, but we don't have time because the pizza's coming. So let me go to the next slide. So what can Disaster Relief volunteers do? We cannot wave a magic wand. We can't do that. But what are some things we can do? What we're going to do is, before we talk about what we can do, I want to talk about what we probably should not do. And Pastor Larry, if you could go get the microphone, we're going to do our little show in a minute. And while he's getting the microphone for us, that didn't take long. Okay, Kim, here's your big chance. All right. So Kim and I are going to do a show real quick for you. And the name of this show is Don't Let This Be You. What is the name of our show? Don't Let This Be You. Okay, so Kim, if you want to sit here. All right, so to set this up, this was not rehearsed, FYI. This is a disaster survivor, and this is the volunteer. No, I don't believe that. No, tell your father, no. Ooh. Hi, are you a disaster victim? You sure look like a victim.
This isn't my best look.
Oh, I know what you mean. This humidity is ruining my hair, and I just paid $150 to have it done. What do you think?
It looks really nice.
Oh, thank you. No. You look like you could use a good cream rinse. So, how much did you lose? You know, did your house get flattened? Honey, are you destitute?
Well, a big tree did fall on our mobile home, and it completely crushed it, and we feel lucky to be alive.
Lucky? You're not lucky to be alive. You're blessed to be alive. If God had wanted to kill you, you'd be dead by now.
I hadn't thought of that.
In fact, it sounds like you're very blessed. Those people in Smallsville lost absolutely everything. There's nothing left. Even their road blew away. At least you people still have a road.
Well, we do have a road, but there are a lot of fallen trees on it, and we can't get through.
You don't need to complain about it. I've heard that the road will be clear by next week. Listen, I remember when a tornado came through our town back in 1946. Of course, I wasn't there, but my mother told me all about it. There were trees everywhere for months. Nobody could get into town. Everything was blocked. You had to walk to church, walk the store. That was really bad. What you have here is not really a disaster. It's more like an inconvenience. I don't even know why we came all this way to cook for you people. The McDonald's in Sticksville is open for business. Are you crying? Oh, wait. I heard about this in disaster relief training. People under stress are more likely to experience serious swings of emotion. They can be optimistic one moment and overwhelmed the next. Would you say you're feeling overwhelmed or just stressed out? Oh, jeez. We don't have to be such a baby about it. At least you still have the clothes on your back, although, I don't know. I wouldn't be seen in public wearing that. Looks like you've been wearing those same clothes for days. Oh, wait, hold on. Oh my gosh. Okay, look, I gotta go. I gotta get back to my work site. I know you people are grateful that we have come to help you. It's our pleasure to help the less fortunate. Now hang on, let me get a picture. This is for my church PowerPoint. That's great, thank you. Wait, oh, I forgot. Jesus loves you, and so do we. Bye. Okay, thank you, Kim. Yes, she did a good job, didn't she? So what did you see? Okay, give an example.
Of her hair.
Okay.
Clothes.
Okay, very critical.
There wasn't anything that you didn't miss.
Okay, that's because I wasn't there long enough.
Pretty much everything you did wrong.
Okay, don't let this be you. All right, so what did you see? Lack of empathy. Okay, can you give an example? Lack of empathy.
When you talk about your hair instead of caring about her.
Okay, more about me than about her.
Comparing.
Okay, looking down on. Okay. The training hadn't taken.
Yeah.
I knew the facts, but I didn't really know operationally what that was. Didn't affect my behavior. Clearly did not affect my behavior. Yes, Doug.
Talking.
Did she do any listening, really? No. The cue, whatever I heard, was just a cue for me to then say what I wanted to say. Yeah. You were going to say?
I was fired.
Oh, okay. What did the volunteer not do that maybe she should have done or would have been better for her to do?
Let her talk more.
Okay. What would be a way to give her space to talk? Ask her, okay. How are you doing? Is there anything our team could do to help you? Was your family affected? Ask some questions. How did the volunteer introduce herself? Did she ask to sit down beside her? Did she ask her for her name? No. Did she seem interested at all? No. Y'all are very quiet. You must be very hungry. If we were going to do this over again, let me just get back to the. So Kim, if you saw more of the gold shirt people coming down the street, would you run out to greet them, or would you run into the house and shut the door?
Absolutely, run in the house.
Okay. So. My little interaction with you did not in any way like make you more open to hearing the gospel of Jesus. That probably wasn't helpful to you. If we did this over with a good volunteer?
You should have asked what you could do.
ask what we could do, how we could help her.
I think listening without then like comparing.
Listening, okay.
Like not offering, something like this happened to me.
I'm topping. It wasn't even my story. It was my mother. I wasn't born yet. Right. So topping it. Right. It's not about me and what's going on with me. It's helping her. And we know that the more people tell their story, the more it helps them heal. And so, for instance, when we're doing assessing, we'll often say, were you at home when this happened? What was that like? And then what happened? And then what did you do? And just kind of help, like kind of get them to talk about what they're dealing with, and that helps them heal. It really helps. And
it depends also on how soon after all this had happened.
Yes.
Because at early stages, they're not ready to go through it yet.
Yes, yes. Well, it depends on the person. It depends on the person. And some people go through those steps a lot easier. Your book, and I know we're at time, so I gotta wrap this up. There are some excellent, excellent resources in your book. Page 22 specifically is going to talk about disaster-related stress and how that affects people. The unexpectedness of disasters is part of what makes it so so stressful for people, but it gives you some ideas of where people are emotionally and mentally. It talks about ways that volunteers, but especially churches, because they're going to be in the area longer term, what they can do. And then on page 23, what it's like to speak with sensitivity toward people, what to say and what not to say. Like saying to people, remember Romans 8:28. Well, first of all, how many people in the general public even know what Romans 8:28 is? That's not very helpful. And if they did know what Romans 8:28 is, which is all things work together for those who... I can even say it. I'm looking at the pastors. It kind of basically makes you think God works everything out okay in the end. And the person, that's not what people need to hear in the middle of a disaster. It could be worse. Get over it. But saying things like, I'm sorry. It sounds like you've been through a lot. Or some of you said this, how can we be of help? Would you mind talking a little bit more about that? Tell me a little bit more about that. Just kind of leading them on. So some really good resources in here. And just one last thing. So, Larry, you've got the right. Yeah, stay on this slide. So it's very, very hard sometimes, especially in flood situations for first-time volunteers, because the damage is extensive and it's very clear. It's going to take a long, long time for people to get to recovery, if at all, because they just don't have the resources. And you feel like you've only done a tiny drop in the bucket for this community. I mean, there are whole houses that we didn't get to. It's very, very difficult because you just really feel for these people. And what we try to encourage people to do is to, number one, just remember God has other people. God sees, God understands, and God's got other people who can be coming in behind you to work. But just rather than focusing on fixing everything, because we can't, to do the best job we can. We can't fix everything, but can we get all the drywall and wet stuff out of this house so it's safe to live in? Yes. Can we get this tree off the front porch so they can get into their house? Yes, we can do that. Be present. You want to be present. It means like you're with the person and you're paying attention. You're not on your phone. You're listening to them. You're focused on them. They can see you nodding. They can see that you're paying attention. You're speaking with sensitivity. Be an agent of hope. Pray. Ask permission with the person before you pray. Sometimes you get the feeling that this is not a religious person. They're not really open to religion. So I just say, can we speak a blessing over you? And then proceed to pray a prayer. Refer to someone who can help, which might be the chaplain, it might be a mental health professional, might be a pastor of a local church, but doing what we can to help. And Larry, if you could just skip to the very last picture, which is Mako. The two takeaways today, one is the help, hope, and healing. The other is what we do is really not The main thing we do is not trees, it's not hot meals. The main thing we do is people. It's people, people, people. Loving people, seeing them where they are, loving them. We can't fix it. But can we help them move a little further along with healing? Can we give them hope? Can we begin to plant seeds that they can step a little bit closer to God in a relationship with him? And that's the end of the class. And I know we've been here for 3 hours. It feels like a day and a half. We didn't touch half of what was in this manual. So please go back and read through this later. There's some really, really good material, especially the last section. Well, have you pray for the food? Because you're paying for the food.
Yeah, I'm doing all this.
Oh, you're doing all this. Okay. Lord, we thank you for the food. We thank you for the ones who prepared it for us. We just thank you for all of the blessings that you have given to us. In Christ's name, amen.
Amen. Thank you.
Guys, thank you. You guys have endured to the end. This is part of the screening if you can't sit and pay attention for a while. You can't. But as Pastor Keith says, learning it and actually operationalizing it are two different things. This is the hardest class you'll ever take in disaster relief. So you just finished it. Thank you. Pastor Larry, are we eating in here?
So down the fellowship hall.
Okay, so we get a change. So we're going to the school cafeteria now. So do we stay if we're going to film your class, Alan?
I guess. I don't know.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Let me get this off.
Get down there, grab.
We can eat in there. Okay.
Yeah. No,
we'll go.
Mine's not anywhere near as long.
No, his is not going to be as long.
I kind of got my laptop this, so I have something to.
That's good.
I can see what's coming up.
That was my problem.